Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we turn to weather and climate issues with our two guests, the weather guys who come by the last Monday of every month, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and past chair.
Ah, yes.
Past. I like that word.
Yes. It's a great word. Great tense.
Well, I tell you what, we've had some pretty picture-perfect fall weather here across the good part of Wisconsin.
It doesn't get better than this. I mean, in fact, I don't know the statistics, but I'm willing to bet, this is anecdotal from my own experience here 20 years, this is really common for at least 1 7- to 10-day period, either in from mid-September to early October. And it's just the most splendid time of the year. You know, if I had my way, I'd have the month of September off instead of sometime, you know, vacationing in July or August. Yeah. I think September is the best time to take off.
Yeah. What is that? Are there some certain things in the atmosphere or whatever that conspire to bring about this 7-day miracle?
It is. That's a perfect way to describe it. It is a 7-day miracle. I'll guess this, and again, it would be really interesting to scrutinize it more, but during the summertime, the jet stream moves poleward and ends up, on average, being around 50 degrees north latitude, which is just to our north. And then it begins gradually to relax back to its normal latitude, somewhere near 30 to 35 degrees for the wintertime. And so we reach the peak of its northern excursion right around mid-early September. And I think as a consequence, it's easier to have anticyclonic weather disturbances at our latitude, and those are almost always characterized by clear skies, both day and night. And it gives you the cool morning and the relatively warm afternoon. A perfect mix.
It's a great mix. Well, now, earlier in the month, though, we had, man, it felt like winter was was coming. So what happened there? And is there maybe a connection to the kind of weather we're having now?
Maybe there is. You know, the flow is wavier in the summertime. I've just recently kind of discovered this with research we've been doing with some colleagues. The flow is wavier in the summertime than it is at any other time of year. It kind of relaxes away from being really high amplitude waviness in the middle troposphere by the time you get to end of September. And so occasionally that's going to mean that in mid-August, when the waviness is kind of dying down, you might find yourself in a position where the waviness brings you cold air instead of warm. Notice we didn't really have any warm heat spell in August, but we did have that cold spell at the end of August and early September. And so it might have just been a matter of where we were relative to these waves. So there's some unanswered stuff there, but there's a basic structure that kind of points in the direction of what the answer might be.
So it's less wavier in the summertime?
It's wavier.
It's wavier in the summertime. Yes. That's not what I would have guessed.
Me either.
It's just not as big an amplitude.
What do you mean by wavy? You're just up.
Just thinking about how the flow would go north and then south and then north and then south over, you know, large horizontal distances. It happens more frequently to a greater extent, and this is a measurable quantity, as it turns out, in the summertime than in the wintertime. Yeah.
It's more constricted, and so you don't see as big an amplitude.
I think that's it, yeah. You know, when the main vortex shrinks toward the pole.
The polar vortex?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never heard of that.
No. We'll introduce it this winter. Then all the stuff that's left at latitude south of the main vortex is cut off more in the summertime than it is in the wintertime. Because when the wintertime occurs, then the big vortex expands and it absorbs all those things.
Yeah. Huh.
So there's nothing left.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
I know, me either. But it's
research,
measurable.
Isn't it?
It's just awesome. I love it when the answer is counterintuitive.
Talking weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And I haven't given you the number, so here it is. If you want to join in, weather or climate question or an experience to share, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you've got a cool weather photo, and boy, over the years or months, we've had some really good weather photos. If you've got a good one, I hope you'll post it up on my Facebook page. Yeah, the Facebook page is titled The Larry Mueller Show. So that's the place to go if you're in the know.
And it's easy to remember.
Yeah, how'd you come up with that name, Larry?
It's an easy one to remember. Well, we've got a caller online. Again, number 1-800-642-1234. Jamie in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. Just had a real quick idea I wanted to share with you. I have a new weather term. I'm calling it, with the crazy weather we've been having lately, the bipolar vortex.
I like it.
That's it. Thanks so much.
Oh, bipolar vortex.
That's if you have the polar vortex just moving around a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened last winter. We actually had that in the Northern Hemisphere. It was warm in Central and Western Europe, and it was cold as all get out here in the U.S.
Oh, I wish I thought of that one.
We'll see if the media picks it up.
No, that's great. That's great.
That is a really, really good one. Oh, man. Well, we got some more callers online, too. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Bipolar vortex. All right. Heidi in New Lisbon. Your turn. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to know if the guest would address the geoengineering and the spraying of geoengineering chemicals, especially aluminum, in the sky and all the trails that we're seeing. And if he has, looked at the website that Dane Wigington has online and all the information that he's proposed, if the speaker would address that, please.
Sure.
Yeah, so geoengineering is where, we're getting global change right now, and geoengineering and that application with regard to climate change are looking at things that we might do to the environment to kind of keep the changes from occurring that we don't want, or in theory we don't want to have change. There is a National Academy of the Sciences coming out with a report on geosciences. I have to know a couple of people on that committee. I don't think the report's out yet. It's probably under review. And I'm really interested to see what the Academy says. This is a group of scientists. I think there's about 15 to 20 of them on the panel, and they're looking at the very aspects of what we can do, if anything. And personally, that's kind of where I stand with regard to the if anything, because once you start to geoengineer things in the way you want the atmosphere to work, it's not guaranteed that that's the way it is going to work, because we don't fully understand the atmosphere. And if we did, we could do 2-week forecasts, but we have a hard time doing 2-week forecasts.
Right.
So I get worried about it. In the 50s and the 60s and even into the 70s, there was a lot of cloud seeding going on, particularly in the Rockies. And the idea there was to get more snowfall. But from there, I did my graduate work in Colorado State University, where there was a lot of work going on with cloud seeding. And it became pretty apparent to me pretty quickly that we just don't really understand how clouds work. And so seeding them maybe isn't the best thing. And statistically, it didn't seem to actually even work. There's a lot of looking out at geoengineering. The other thing that raises my concern is the amount of energy. So, for example, one thing they were looking at in terms of trying to offset global warming was to put a bunch of particles up in the atmosphere that could scatter out the solar energy before it gets to heat the planet up. But to get a lot of particles up there to do that, that requires a lot of energy.
It sure does.
And it's the flip side of that energy article that is also a concern.
And it's one of the things that we know least about, as Steve pointed out, in terms of the broad-scale climate radiation balance, is this so-called indirect effect of aerosols. And, why do you go? You just don't want to go down the path, I think, and this is my bias, of course, that I'm showing you, but you want to go down the path of fiddling with knobs in a machine of which you don't know what they do to the machine. It's just not the smart way to go, and especially when you have alternatives that have a clear return to a more natural state that more than likely is going to lead you towards solutions that you're looking for. So I'll be interested to see what that National Academy study
really
says, too.
Yeah, because that panel had people, scientists on there who are actually looking at it as a research scientist, too. So it's a knowledgeable, it's just not a political group that's getting together. So I'm really, and I know there were some heated debates in those meetings.
I bet there were.
Thanks, Heidi, for calling. Appreciate it. Roger in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I missed part of the cloud question, but I have another cloud question.
Okay.
How do clouds form? Basic science says we should have diffusion and things should spread out to reach equilibrium. So how do clouds collect to form their concentrated mass?
Yeah, there's a couple of things working there. One is clouds are composed of tiny liquid water droplets or ice crystals. It's not water vapor. You can't see the invisible water vapor. So the manifestation, the visible manifestation of a cloud is already involved a phase change from invisible water vapor to liquid water or ice. The thing that holds them together in one way, well, there's two aspects, I think, that can help to explain how they hold together. One is clouds form in regions where the air is rising to higher elevation. And that doesn't happen uniformly over even a limited area. It happens over sort of small puffs of rising air surrounded by puffs of sinking air. And in the sinking air, you're not going to form a cloud. So that's one thing that helps to create a cloud field. The other is the fact that the phase change from vapor to liquid or vapor to ice takes place on a foreign object, like a piece of pollen or a piece of dust or something else like that, naturally occurring foreign objects, pieces of salt in the atmosphere. And so there's a predilection for these things to occur on small objects that are naturally occurring in the atmosphere. So when you couple the fact that there are preferred sites for this vapor to condense or turn into ice to change its phase, with the fact that only certain areas of the atmosphere are rising and will therefore undergo that phase change, you can kind of use that as a basic argument for why clouds can form in limited regions and therefore hold their integrity.
Yeah. And Barry. Yeah, the other thing I was just going to add to that is that, you know, when you look at some clouds, and this usually is the case for cirrus clouds, ice clouds that are high in the atmosphere, going back to your comment about diffusion, Roger, that's where you begin to see diffusion kind of taking a place, because the particles begin to spread out, and that diffuseness actually gives you these very diffuse edges as the ice particles begin to evaporate as they mix with the air.
And ice withstands sublimation better than water. Liquid water withstands evaporation, so you can really get wispy when it's ice, but you don't get wispy when it's water in the clouds.
There you go. Thank you very much for that question, Roger. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today, our weather guys, they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to answer your questions. Call us at 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Never a shortage of things to talk about with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They're going to be talking about what we can experience on the horizon weather-wise, answer your questions as well. We can talk climate with them, too, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve also directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. So always fun to have them along. And already some great photos up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. There's one with I like a lot. Somebody took. It's a bright blue background. Daniel took it. He says drop cloth. So it's probably an oil cloth of some sort, which beads the water.
Oh,
up.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, is that, it's probably dew, right?
Could be, if he left it out on his windshield or something, you know, like that.
Because raindrops would probably, you'd get too many, then they'd break up.
Yeah, and you'd see streams probably. Yeah, that's probably right.
I think so.
That's probably right.
And he also posted another shot, which is really cool. He says, cue the trumpets.
That looks like a nice sunset where the sky gets nice and orangey, yellow.
Yeah.
Really, really pretty. And we also had a beauty from Nancy Waller, who says this is sunrise on her farm in Taylor, Wisconsin. Mm. Oh. You're not going to see a prettier shot than that.
No, sir.
Yeah, the reds in the cloud. Again, there's sunrises and sunsets. I should sing that, I guess. You know, a lot of the blues and the sunlight get scattered out, and so the reds and the yellows reflect off the clouds.
And there's another shot of morning dew.
It's that time of year to get dew.
Yeah, it is indeed. Right? Yep, warm days. Relatively warm, moist air and cool nights. Nights longer than the day now.
Yeah.
For about
depressing.
A week.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a window. There's a one of these windows in the roof. I forget what you call them now. Of the
Skylight?
Skylight.
Yeah.
Skylight. And I, in my daughter's room, and I noticed this morning that it was covered with dew.
Yeah, dewy.
Yeah, I know. To get on the grass now early in the morning. Yep. It's wet. It's just...
Yeah. What about golf, Larry? You must not want to get out to an early tee time at this time of year. You want 10 a.m. or something, not 8.
Any time. I never
get out anymore. Thunderstorming and raining and he's out there.
Oh, man. Alan and La Crescent, your turn. Thanks for calling, by the way.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I don't know if this is anecdotal or if there is actually a trend, but being an astute weather observer and watching weather satellite photos all the time, it seems over the last couple of years, and specifically this year into the spring and summer, there's been an awful lot of upper-level lows that kind of sit and spin over a given area. I think there's one out in the Rockies right now. Is it unusual, or am I dreaming this, or is there have been a difference as far as the number of these?
I'm not prepared, Alan, to tell you if you're dreaming, and I'll tell you, and I'm not saying that as a joke. I'm just beginning to really do some pretty serious methodical research on a question that you bring up, is whether what's the population of cutoff disturbances in the middle part of the troposphere. Other people have done climatologies, and we're trying to impose another measure on top of that to see whether or not that might be true. My suspicion, though, right now is that it's not true. What you're seeing, the thing today over Colorado, is actually the first vestige of what starts to develop in that part of the country climatologically and leads, in fact, to the Santa Ana winds in Southern California that'll come about 2 weeks from now. So this is kind of fitting a climatological pattern where cutoff lows start to develop over the southwest United States in late September and early October. And I don't think, I've been struck myself anyway, and I look at the weather maps frequently like you do, I don't think I've been struck by an overabundance of them over the last couple of years as compared to the prior 25. And I've been looking at them fairly regularly for that long a time. So I'm not prepared to say that that's the case. Neither can I deny it.
So I was just wondering about John's research with the waviness we were talking about.
Yeah, looking
at that, right?
Yeah, exactly. It has to do with the waviness, yeah. And the waviness is on a rapid decline by the time you get to the late part of September. But there are certain parts of the Northern Hemisphere that resist that trend, and one of them is the Southwest U.S.
There we go. Thanks, Alan, for calling. Tom in Black River. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a global warming skeptic, and I got a couple questions to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain why, if man and his activities at coal-fired power plants caused global warming, why did the Ice Age glaciers melt 10,000 years ago? It evidently warmed up, so I was wondering why they melted if man and his activities is what caused global warming. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say in response, and Steve will have things to say to it, I'd say in response that there's many, many geological episodes of warming and cooling of the planet Earth, and there are cycles that control those episodes. The tilt of the Earth's axis relative to the sun is not constant over a long geological time. It actually changes rather substantially, a couple of degrees, and that makes a big difference for how cold or warm it can stay at the high latitudes, both northern and southern hemisphere. So that can either, when it's colder, it'll expand the ice. When it's warmer, of course, it'll shrink the ice on the caps. That's one thing. And then there are orbital eccentricities in terms of how far away the Earth actually is from the sun that are, again, over very, very long geological times. And the argument that's being made right now is not that the only time the planet can warm is as a result of human activity. It's just that the most recent warming seems to be tied substantially to human activity. So those are two very different statements. There are things going on in the background over hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of years, that certainly do exert an influence on the Earth's climate. But nothing, but also human activity can, in a very shorter period of time, influence changes that are just as large as those that are that work over a very long time. And that's what the argument is right now, is that human activity has made a substantial change in the Earth's climate over the last 150, 200 years.
So there are different statements. So it's accelerated this change? Is that what it is?
Yeah, and the other things may not even be working in phase with the anthropogenic effects. They may be working out of phase with it, but it doesn't matter. The anthropogenic effects are so large that they're exerting this influence.
Yeah, there's no way to explain it in natural variability. And,
right.
and it's consistent. It's not just about the global warming. It's other impacts then in terms of the amount of snowfall, the amount of glaciers, the amount of sea ice, the length of the growing season. When we get frost and don't get frost, it all hangs together. I mean, there's not any kind of red herring type of data set out there that really raises concerns about whether or not we understand the science, and we do.
Mm-hmm.
Physics tells us you add more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you're going to warm it up.
Right.
And we've known that since the 1800s.
Right. And carbon dioxide is the oxidation result of burning fossil fuels, which are carbon that's been taken out of play. And when you put them back into play at a rapid rate, and it's a global industry, so the people in charge of it have a perfect inventory of what's been mined and then sold and then burned, the numbers add up. Yeah. It's very, very strong evidence.
Carl in Madison, your turn. Thanks, Carl, for calling.
Yes, hello. Just exactly what the gentlemen were just talking about in terms of the, it's not simply that this is a man-made period of warming, and there have been other natural periods of warming, and so someone who was a climate skeptic might shrug their shoulders and say, well, if it warms and it cools, then what's the big deal? It's the fact that this warming is at such a rapid rate that the evolutionary processes that animals use to adjust to, you know, climatic shifts over thousands of years, there's just no time for the flora and fauna to do all that they need to do to remain viable in such a short shift of, just a fundamental shift in temperatures and climate in the span of a lifetime or two. So I think it's very important as people debate these issues, certainly to get the facts. But if there are still people out there who are thinking that climate change might not be real or that global warming might not be scientifically sound, it would be wonderful to get out there and do some more reading and some more research, because it's not just that it's warming, but it's what we're doing to all of the species and our own breadbasket and everything else that's tied into such a rapid rate of global temperature increase, and then the global weirding that is partly a result of that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good comment. The evidence really stacked up towards this is happening and it's real. And the complexities then that follow on in terms of ecosystems is really amazing. I think we were just reading an article regarding polar bears. We've heard about the shrinking ice, and so they can't get at the seals. But apparently there's been an explosion in the amount of snow geese. And they're actually changing the ecosystems of the tundra, because there's so many of them. It went from like 2 million to 15 million.
Wow.
And so the polar bears are now, I mean, that's becoming a food source for them. They're eggs. I mean, we were reading, I think it was one polar bear ate 12,000 eggs in a day.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's
and the reason why you're getting more geese is not necessarily, well, a part of it is the warming of the Arctic region, but also it's their winter season, which used to be along the Gulf, and how that's changing, and then how the ecosystems in the Gulf regions are changing so that they've actually migrated during the wintertime further northward and are feeding on vegetation, farm fields, and things like that. So their actual winter breeding ground has actually, or winter grounds have increased in size, which has allowed them, their populations to explode.
Wow. Yeah.
So it gets really complicated really quick.
Yeah, right. That's right. And yet what isn't complicated at the foundational level is that the planet's average temperature is going up, and there will be consequences regionally and in ecosystems, and people are trying to figure out what those will be. But just because we don't have the answers to all those detailed next-level questions doesn't mean that the foundational notion that the human activity has changed the climate is not true. So it's not – sometimes people will be skeptical because they don't believe the last piece of a long line of argument, and they forget that what they're actually claiming skepticism about is the most foundational idea.
Right.
And that's not really a fair way to make your point.
Yeah.
Kenneth in Janesville, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hello. To everything or every time there is a season, and we do know what caused the ice ages, and aren't we in the beginning of another one? And
not for a couple of thousands of years yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the changes we're seeing now are not due to these natural cyclations of the Earth going around the sun. Those are on a lot bigger time scales. I'm trying to think of an analogy that we could look. Well, it's like mountain forming, right?
Yeah,
you can't look at the Rockies and say, well, that the Rockies aren't changing because we haven't seen anything in a little bit. They are changing, but on very, very big timescales.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that ice age, if you were just kind of looking without any impact from man, you'd still be a couple.
The shortest one is 25,000 years is the time scale of that. And then it's 40,000 and 100.
Now, it may be true. I don't know if this is true or not. I can't recall, but it's starting to ring a familiar bell in my head that the current maybe you're saying this, the current direction in which the natural climate is headed is towards another cool period some thousands of years downstream, not that many thousands of years. But this interruption by human activity is actually changing the direction entirely and warming things up. Okay, that then that's
in kind a short of amount of time.
Yeah, okay.
There you go, Ken. Thanks. Adele in Door County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm calling from Sturgeon Bay, or Door County, actually. And in this area, there has been an inordinate explosion of acorn formation this summer, and they're now falling. I am wondering, and perhaps this is a tree question, or perhaps it's a weather question, is there any correlation between lots and lots of acorns and the coming winter?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think
it's so much the coming winter as what happened
in the summer, right? In the spring?
Summer, and even the summer of the year before. Because if you stress the trees are going to produce more acorns. And when we had stressful conditions for trees the last couple of years where we had a drought.
Yeah, right. This year in Sturgeon Bay, it probably wasn't that dry, though, I think. Is that right?
We had a lot of rain.
Yeah, that's what I thought. We were preserved from that just a little south of you, but I think it was rainy this summer in Sturgeon Bay, but it was dry last year and the years before, relatively speaking.
And cold last winter, certainly.
Right, that's right. And this is a very interesting question because this is one of the things that I think can lead to maybe arguments that get made that are kind of not putting the cart before the horse. So let's say you have a lot of acorns. That's an observational fact. We're trying to figure out what that might stem from. And I think it is a tree stress that maybe has its roots, no pun intended, in prior times, the weather at prior times, and therefore has no ability to foretell the future. But then you see a lot more squirrel activity digging those things up. And then if the winter happens to be cold, everyone logically almost draws the conclusion, wow, the squirrels knew ahead of time. And actually all they're doing is reacting to the fact that there's an unusually easy and large amount of food at our disposal. Let's dig it up and make sure we store it away. We don't know what's coming. So, you know, you can end up getting a story that says, hey, when you have a lot of acorns, the winter's going to be bad because the squirrels will be in a frenzy. Well, you'd be in a frenzy, too, if you had a lot of free food that you could go and pick up, you know. So I think that's kind of an interesting point.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Betty, we'll get to you in just a minute. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. We have an absolutely remarkable photograph
that is awesome.
On my Facebook page. Listen, if you're near a computer or at some point, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and look at this photo from Brandon. Look at that cloud.
Where was that taken? Does it say?
It's on a beach, but it's a harbinger of a thunderstorm that's heading their way. An arc cloud?
And it's not that high. Yeah. Look at how...
Oh, yeah, those are...
You see the people on the left side of the photo that don't appear to be... The clouds appear to be very, very low.
They are.
They don't appear to be running towards indoors. Maybe they want to get wet because you could see the hail shaft, the rain shaft behind it as well.
Right.
So it's a gorgeous.
That's an awesome event. Now,
it even looks like there's some mamadas in the upper right, of the image as well.
That could be, up at White Sands Beach or whatever it's called there on Door County, that beautiful beach that's on the bay side,
or
the Lake Michigan side. But that is gorgeous. And if anybody looks at that and doesn't have at least a tingle of awestruck about the atmosphere, I don't know what to do for them. Get off the bus. Nothing else is going to happen that'll get you excited.
Unbelievable. Yeah, Brandon, let us know where that photo was taken.
That's great.
I would really love to know. You might be White Sand Beach.
Doesn't it kind of look like that?
Yeah, it does.
The green water.
Betty in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Well, thank you, and I'm going to change course completely for the guys.
Okay.
Good.
Okay. In our family, there is dementia, and I just have noticed the weather really affects people with this type of, well, I don't know about Alzheimer's, really, but I'm wondering if you all ever talk to neurologists or have a meeting and maybe down the line can find some things that help because it really does affect them in that there's a little more animosity.
Huh.
Under certain weather conditions.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I really am not being facetious about it.
Yeah.
I just found that it was, it's just very interesting. I wanted to pass it on to you because I think that it does make people act a little different.
That's interesting. You know, there's so many connections between the weather and psychology, the weather and some physical rheumatism, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not at all crazy to suggest that there would be a strong connection between weather conditions and aspects of or manifestations of dementia. I've not heard of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you, Betty. It's something to ponder for sure. Cindy in Glidden wants something from you guys. Hi, Cindy. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I was wondering if they could simply predict the winter for us.
Yes.
I know I've heard
simply? Are you sure you want to use that adverb, Cindy?
Go to the Farmer's Almanac if you want simple.
what are we looking for here?
Okay, I will make a prediction.
I know what you're going to predict.
And I'll tell you,
make an easy, simple one.
Yep, and it is really, Cindy, and no pun, no joke intended. This is the simplest forecast. We had a long, cold, persistently cold winter last year. The chances of getting exactly that or worse in the coming year are just statistically small. So I'm going to say that almost no matter what really does happen, most people will look at this coming winter as less severe than the one we just went through. I'm going to guess that. Now, that is not specific. That's not one thing we didn't have much of, at least in the southern part of the state last year, was snow. So maybe the snow difference, if there is one this year, will overturn that, even if the temperature difference is milder this year. But I would say most people are not going to remember the coming winter as more severe than the last one because the last one was so unusually long and persistent. But I don't have any physical anything else to tell you physically right now.
And I'll even get a little more specific and say that it was going to be a warmer winter than normal for a couple of reasons.
Because of El Nino.
Right. There's a weak El Nino. Unfortunately, it's good that it's not a strong El Nino because that usually means we don't get enough snowfall in the northern part of the state either. So, yeah, there's a weak El Nino developing, and that usually means that we're a little bit warmer than average. So that's what I would go with.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And the forecast for that event was stronger in the middle of the summer than it is
now. Yeah, they've been weakening.
So
yeah.
It's the forecast intensity of it continues to collapse, and I wonder if it won't collapse entirely by the time we get to November and December. We'll have to keep our eye on that.
Now that I said it, I'm sure that it will collapse.
Yeah.
And we'll have a colder winter this time than we did last year.
That'd be a total. The house would lose entirely on that.
What about snow? If it's a weak El Nino, then snow probably average? Or
It's kind of like it could be above, below, or at average. Mm. We don't really know. It's kind of a toss of the dice.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There you go.
I'll go ahead and buy that extra load of firewood then.
I would do that.
Do it. That's right. And then you could always use it next winter.
Right.
There you go. I'm having a neighbor who's got a storehouse of firewood for the coming winter.
Mm-hmm.
I look at all the work that must have gone into that.
Yeah.
And I think, man, he's got to be in good shape.
It is people who like to do it. I'm one of them.
My dad was like that, too. Yeah, there's rows and rows of lard.
Yeah.
He lived on Long Island. It's like, come on.
Right.
It's that cold.
It'll be 10 degrees one morning this year.
Oh, boy. Well, I tell you what, we are out of time. Where'd it go? So you're saying probably okay, better than last winter.
That's what I think, but it's not physical. Steve's got a more physical reason behind his.
Yeah.
Yep.
Unless you like really cold winters, and then it won't be better than last year.
Right.
Well, I don't like really cold winters. I can tell you that for free.
You know, the good thing, though, ice on the Great Lakes kept it from evaporating.
That's
so
true.
Ice level, water
true.
Levels have caught up.
That is true.
So that's a good thing.
Very good thing.
Yep.
Guys, we'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks so much.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. They'll be back the last Monday of next month, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at childhood obesity and maybe how to prevent that through physical activity. And then how about separation or divorce and its effect on children? Thanks for listening. Stay with us.